When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Welcome to the Julia Hartley Brewer Daily. If you've missed any of my talk radio breakfast show, don't worry. We've put some of the punchiest bits of this morning's show into a bite-sized podcast, the Julia Hartley Brewer Daily. Enjoy.
Talk radio. Julia Hartley Brewer at breakfast on Talk Radio.
Good morning to you. This is Talk Radio Breakfast with me, Julia Hartley Brewer. Delighted to welcome my next guest to the show, Cabinet Office Minister Michael Gove. Good morning to you. Good morning to you, Michael. Can you hear me?
Hi, good morning to you.
I know you've just escaped the clutches of Piers Morgan, so out of the frying pan into the fire, I fear for you. But on very different grounds. Can you tell me where in the 48-page assessment that was published by the government yesterday afternoon, in terms of the wider impacts on health and in the economy, they're provided any justification for the tier restrictions that are going to start tomorrow?
Well, the document I think was very clear. Firstly, it has been the case that the tier restrictions that we had before November were not enough in order to be able to ensure that the R rate, the infection rate, was brought down. The lockdown measures that we have in place have brought that infection rate down. Under the new tier three, we can be confident that infection rates will be reduced. Tier two is a way of effectively stabilizing and in some circumstances reducing infection. Tier one, not effective in reducing infections, but appropriate where infection rates are low. And overall, unless you bring the infection rate below one, then the number of infections will double over time, and that will lead to the overwhelming of the NHS.
Okay. You wrote an article in The Times, a very lengthy article, about how the lockdown had been the only way to stop the NHS being broken. There is no evidence that infections were, you know, doubling at the time that the lockdown was brought in. No evidence that the NHS was about to be overwhelmed. Still isn't any evidence. Even in terms of tier restrictions, you're saying not being enough. Actually, infection rates were falling in the tier three places like the hotspots, like Liverpool. Why do you base government policy on evidence which is not available, it would appear, to anyone who's looking at it, whether a member of the public or indeed the scientists looking at it from externally, given that it's not based on publicly available data?
Yes, it is. The ONS figures showed that the R rate was above one in every part of the United Kingdom.
It did not show that infections were doubling, and it did not show that the NHS was about to be overwhelmed. No public or private documents that I've seen since have suggested any of that was the case, but that was used to justify the lockdown, and you've justified the restrictions saying that the lockdown had brought it down and we need to carry this on. But there's never been any data that's actually been produced, not a model, but actual data of what's happening now on the ground on the day that you make those decisions that justifies any of those moves.
Again, I'd refer you to the ONS figures that showed that the infection rate was doubling on average every 15 days in the 6 weeks up to the announcement of the November measures on the 31st of October.
It was going up at a slower rate. In large parts of the country, it was actually going down.
The R rate was above one in every region of the country. Mm-hmm. And of course, if the R rate is above one, sooner or later, the infection rate will double. The higher it is above one, the faster it's doubling. And of course, if the infection rate doubles, so the number of hospitalizations inevitably increase, with hospital capacity at the moment around 88%, there is some spare capacity in the system. But obviously, if you increase the number of COVID patients, then that means that other patients aren't being treated. And that means that health outcomes are worse.
OK, but it's not at a particularly unusual level of capacity at the moment than it is from any other year. And you know that as well as I do. The Times today have produced a...
The NHS faces significant pressure. You're right.
It does every
December,
year.
And particularly in January and in February. But what would overwhelm it would be the existence of a significant number of additional COVID cases. And it is the case that other countries, from Sweden to France to Canada, have taken similar measures in order to ensure that their health services aren't overwhelmed and their economies aren't damaged.
Michael, we didn't elect the government of Sweden or France. I thought one of the reasons why we voted for Brexit, which a campaign you were very strong on, was to take back control. We get to decide our own policies, don't we? We don't have to do what other countries do. The Times front page today...
But we can learn from them. I think one of the reasons for taking back control is, of course, being accountable. But the question that inevitably will be asked is, which country has an alternative model to the one that so many Western countries have chosen, which people think would be better? Of course, we can always refine the measures that we have. But the question is, what is your alternative? And I haven't seen a coherent one yet.
Oh, I think Sweden has provided a coherent one in terms of the lack of liberty taken away. But there we are. The Times today has produced a secret dossier.
In Sweden, Julia, there are restrictions.
There are very few restrictions. They're largely voluntary.
No, they're not. Yes, there are criminal sanctions. There are criminal sanctions for people who break those restrictions. And it's also the case that Sweden has a rising hospitalisation, rising death rate, which is why other restrictions, tragically...
The death rate is a fraction of ours per capita at the current time.
It's increasing at the moment.
It's
which
a
is
fraction
why
of ours per capita. Yes, with all due respect, it's December. Respiratory illnesses tend to go up in December. They do every single year. But can I get on to something else?
Death rates are going up in Sweden.
Death rates are going, yes. Do you want to tell me what the death rate is, what the number of people who are dying in Sweden right now is?
It's increasing rapidly. That's why they've got measures.
It's at tiny, tiny, tiny levels. But anyway,
it's significantly greater than all its neighbours, significantly greater than Norway.
I'm not going to get sidelined on this. There are lots of different reasons for that. And you will know those as well as I do. I want to talk about the Times front page today. Secret dossier on COVID damage. Yesterday, we had this impact assessment at 48 pages, which contained the most extraordinary line I think I've ever read in supposedly a detailed assessment of what the economic impacts of COVID measures would be. It says, any attempt to estimate specific economic impacts of precise changes to individual restrictions for a defined period of time would be subject to such wide uncertainty as to not be meaningful for precise policy making. Yet the government has used very imprecise and very uncertain SAGE modelling for the virus's impact. Modelling that, by the way, has been proven to be wrong again and again and again by a huge factor. And yet the Times today have got a secret dossier that the government has drawn up showing huge economic impact. Which is it? Has the government drawn up an economic impact assessment or hasn't it?
There are three things I'd say there. The first is that if we look at the modelling of the growth of the infection, that modelling has been pretty robust. On the second point, again, about the... Yes, and the second point, I was just talking about the ONS figures earlier, which showed the rates of doubling and which were in line with SPIM and other models from which scientists have had high confidence. Again, you didn't seem to have those ONS figures to hand. That's fair enough. On the second point about the economic impact, we know, everybody knows, the OBR reminded us of the dreadful economic impact of the pandemic, but it's the pandemic that's generating the economic impact. On the third thing, I think it is the case that the document which you refer, which I haven't read myself, is based on publicly available information from the ONS and other sources of statistics.
OK. By the way, I do have those ONS figures to hand because it was 51,900 new infections between the 17th and the 23rd of October. It had fallen to 45,700 by the 25th to the 31st of October. 51,900 is a higher number than 45,700. It's definitely not a double that number, is it?
Well, the rates were doubling.
The rates were doubling, but you said I didn't have... I do have those figures to hand. You were quoting the ONS figures... The ONS figures show they were falling, not doubling.
They were doubling on average in every 15 days in the 6 weeks up to the announcement of the November measures on the 31st of October.
I'll have to agree to disagree. I mean, I'm just quoting the official ONS figures. I do apologise for that. Can I ask you about Nadeem Zahawi?
So am I. I don't make any apology for that.
Okay. Nadeem Zahawi is a vaccine minister, looking at the rollout. He's talked about how the vaccine won't be mandatory, won't be required. You're not going to be actually holding people down and forcing them to have the vaccine. I mean, that's something to be grateful for, I suppose. But that there may well be businesses, whether it's airlines or pubs or cinemas that say, basically, you can't come in unless you have got proof you've had a vaccine. Is that going to happen?
No, that's not the plan. Our plan is to make sure that we distribute the vaccine to all those who need it. We want to make sure that, first of all, those people who are vulnerable, those who are older, those who are in care homes, get vaccinated, and then also the frontline NHS and social care staff upon whom we depend. And then we want to spread the vaccine more widely thereafter.
Okay. And what is the timetable for that? Because I can understand we haven't got a vaccine, not one of these yet has been approved by the regulators. And the moment it is approved, we know we've already bought a lot of these supplies. Yeah. We've got millions already. I mean, again, all credit to the government on that, buying all these vaccines in advance, getting them manufactured. So when they're approved, we can roll them out. That is one of the big ticks. Well done. You get that from me. I'll give you credit when you get it right. However, I want to know you're welcome. I want to know what the actual timetable is, because please God tell me that the government has got a very clear outline and timetable for when these are going to be rolled out.
Yes, you're absolutely right. It's subject, of course, to clearance by the regulator. But provided we get that clearance, and of course the whole world is waiting for that clearance, then the first vaccinations should take place this month. And then we will increase the numbers in the new year.
By what date will everybody who is vulnerable or elderly have the vaccine? And by what date will everyone be able to have the vaccine? Because this is the stuff that government is paid to do, to plan and organise. So can you give me so if, I mean, on any given day, let's say on the 1st of January, we get one of these vaccines approved. On what date from the 1st of January will we have access to everybody who's elderly or vulnerable and everyone else to get that vaccine?
The first thing is that we're going to have, provided they're approved by the regulator, millions of vaccines available in December. And so we will start that
program. I was being generous.
Program.
I was saying first.
I hope we'll get it by then. It will be the case that we will progressively increase the number of people who are vaccinated through January to April. And I would hope that by April or May, that we would have universal coverage. But of course, what we're working on now is making sure that we can have that distribution mechanism working with the NHS in order to ensure that everyone who needs a vaccine gets it.
OK, but you're saying by April or May. Originally, it was by Easter, and then it's April or May. I've heard ministers say we wouldn't have even all the most vulnerable vaccinated by that time. It seems to change depending on which minister I speak to. But there must be, surely, a clear rollout plan. You knew these vaccines were on the way. You know you've got the army ready to deploy on this. Surely you can actually do the logistics. How many sites do we need? How many people do we need? How many people can we push through in any given day, whether it's in a stadium? So you must have an actual date, not a hope, a date.
Well, the date depends on both the clearance for those vaccines and also the nature of the vaccine. So to take the Pfizer vaccine, there are 46 mass vaccination centres that we've identified. One of the reasons why mass vaccination centres are favoured is because of the cold chain storage pressures that mean that when you're dealing with that vaccine, it needs to be stored for most of its life at a particularly low temperature. You can distribute it outside those mass vaccination centres, but there is a limited time period during which you can visit those in care homes and others. Of course, if the Oxford vaccine, the AstraZeneca vaccine, receives its clearance, then it can be distributed both at lower cost and in a faster way. But what we can't do is anticipate exactly when both are going to come into play. So that's why we've got a system both of cold chain distribution for Pfizer, the 46 vaccine centres that I mentioned, and also NHS General Hospital being used in order to vaccinate their own staff and others.
I know I've got to let you go, but we've got you a little bit late because Piers Morgan does that to us. Just finally, I want to ask you, tier restrictions come into force tomorrow. Very likely, of course, the vote is going to go through even without the Labour voting for it and lots of rebels not voting for it. But can you explain to me, I mean, because I'm really struggling with why it's okay and safe for me to go to a pub and have a drink with a meal, whether it's a Scotch egg or a full fish and chips or whatever, and that will make me safe. But if I have a drink without a meal in situ, then that will make me at risk. But I can drink at a cinema or a football stadium or a theatre when those are reopened without a meal. Can you explain to me how the virus knows whether I'm standing up, sitting down, or whether or not I've got a meal next to my drink?
It's about mingling and reducing that. So in other countries which have also got similar restrictions, table service is a means of reducing the risk. So
what's that got to do with meals?
Served? Well, if you're sat at the table eating the meal.
No, but what's the meal got to do with it? Have you been to a pub since they reopened on the 4th of July, Michael?
Yes, I have.
Have you been to a pub where you've been allowed to stand or go to the bar?
I saw several people standing and indeed going to the bar.
Where?
In the pub that I was in. I was myself
House
sitting
of Commons?
Down. No. It was actually, I probably shouldn't name the pub because I didn't want to advertise it, but it was a pub in West Kensington where I went with my son and others in order to have a substantial meal and to watch Chelsea.
But people are only allowed to be served in the pubs at the table. So why does the virus know that you're having a drink at the table or that you're having a drink and a lasagna at the table? How does the pub know? How does the virus know?
Because we know that table service, driven by the need to serve meals and to serve people at the table, is safer.
It's a requirement in law that you're served at the table. That's a requirement right now in pubs that
yes.
are open. So what's it got to do
yes,
with
exactly.
the meal?
It means that it is easier to ensure that we're policing table service appropriately.
We're going to basically close down hundreds of thousands of businesses for that, and that's the answer.
It is the case that the pandemic, as you quite rightly point out, causes economic damage. But the question always
is... The pandemic
is,
doesn't cause economic damage, Michael. Lockdown policy does.
What would be the alternative to restrictions on the spread of the virus? Unless we have restrictions on the spread of the virus, then the number of people who will become infected and go into hospital will overwhelm the NHS, and that would cause real long-term economic damage.
Across the UK, online, on DAB, and on your smart speaker, Talk Radio.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Dio. Online, on DAB, and on the Talk Radio app. Talk Radio.
Okay, well, let's talk to Andrew Bridgen now. He's Conservative MP for North West Leicestershire. I believe you're in Tier 3, are you not, Andrew? Even though an awful lot of your constituency is actually a rural area to the northwest of Leicester. Do you know how you're going to vote today?
Yes. Unfortunately, I'm going to be voting against the government today. My major concern is not the fact that we're in Tier 3, although we entered the latest lockdown in Tier 1. Is the fact that we're geographically linked with Leicester, which, given their track record throughout the pandemic, the Labour administration in Leicester, they were the first local lockdown. They've had millions of pounds of government support through Public Health England, the NHS, to suppress the virus, but they've failed to do so. The city mayor has been exposed repeatedly breaking the lockdown himself and treats it as insignificant. And what my constituents know is that while we're linked to Leicester, it really doesn't matter what we do to suppress the virus in northwest Leicestershire. We're not coming out of Tier 3. And it's like being locked in a burning building for them. And that's not fair. So I can't vote for a Labour administration, an inept Labour administration in Leicester, who's already destroyed thousands of hospitality businesses in the city and affected people's lives. I can't accept for them to be inflicting that on my constituents. So I asked for a decoupling of Northwest Leicestershire from Leicestershire, but I didn't get that assurance, unfortunately.
I'm sure you know the good people of Northwest Leicestershire will be pleased to know that you're not trying to, as you say, carry on one of them being locked in a burning building. But it seems to me an awful lot of the Tory MPs who are now opposed to these measures, and indeed a lot of the Labour MPs who've been speaking out about it, are only concerned because they think that their constituents are in the wrong tier. They didn't seem to be that bothered when other people's constituents were in the wrong tier, or when everyone was in a lockdown and, well, it was all unfair together. There seems to be a little bit of sort of confusion about, you know, whether or not, you know, is this a philosophical issue about people's right to liberty, to you know, to their livelihoods? Is this about the fact that you don't believe that these sort of measures will actually save lives and will do a lot of damage far greater than the lives they will save? Or is this just about, you know, wanting to make sure that you don't have angry constituents in 2024 at the next general election?
And my majority is 20,400, has gone up at every election since 2010 when I took the seat from Labour.
You reckon no. You'll be safe?
Well, that's up to the people of Northwest Leicestershire. But, you know, at the end of the day, our figures in Northwest Leicestershire are 320. That is twice as high as they were when we entered the lockdown period. The second lockdown, that is the fact that we've got no herd immunity in Northwest Leicestershire. We've kept the virus out, but we were surrounded by areas with higher incidence of the virus. I accept that at the moment we need to be in tier three, but even by the time we go into tier three, if the bill passes tonight, by the time we go into tier three, we're probably well down from those figures. The figures are dropping, but the fact is that there's no prospect of ever getting out of tier three while we're linked to Leicester. They've failed for 10 months to get themselves under control, and what I do worry is that once people think, well, it doesn't matter what we do, we're still going to be stuck in the highest tier, then the discipline goes and people start breaking the rules on the basis it doesn't matter. And that would be an appalling situation, having come all this way and not carrying the people with us. And
well, that's people are tired. There is now a lack of trust because, of course, we can see the evidence that the government says doesn't exist for why these measures don't work, why they're often unfair, why they're arbitrary, why they're silly. I mean, you know, the table meal rule in pubs in tier two and others. I mean, these things are... they're patently ridiculous, some of these. The fact that you can have a drink without a meal at the cinema or the theatre or a sports ground, but you can't buy a drink without a table meal in a pub. I mean, this stuff, does a Scotch egg or a bowl of pasta or whatever it is count? I mean, this stuff is so patently ridiculous. It's hard for anyone to take the government's measures seriously now because they clearly haven't got a clue what they're doing, have they?
I wouldn't say that that's correct. I think they've made some sensible decisions.
Which ones? I'm all ears. Well, which ones?
The 10 p.m. curfew was...
No evidence for that?
...was ridiculous. And so relaxing that to drinking up time, allowing people to drift off over the next hour and not overload public transport... That's a very...
Wait a minute. So
measure.
Having a ridiculous rule for which there's no medical evidence, but making it slightly less ridiculous by allowing people to drink up for an hour, that makes it OK. Wouldn't it not be better just to not have the ridiculous rule in the first place?
Well, they won't be doing that in my state because, unfortunately, I'll be returning there tomorrow after the vote tonight. And we're in tier three, so our hospitality industries are not open. Well, what I'm not going to allow is that my hospitality industries are beholden to poor decisions made by a Labour administration in Leicester that they didn't vote for and don't support, and there's no prospect of us ever getting out of the burning building. And people have to have hope, Julia, and this takes away hope for my constituents.
Well, this is it, and we're told this will go on until sort of, you know, early February, just in one word, just 9 weeks, but that's 9 weeks before, you know, we see the absolute devastation of the job losses and the business losses. We're told there are two routes out of this. One is the vaccine, and there's talk now of basically it being not mandatory, but effectively, if you don't have proof that you've had a vaccine, you won't be able to do anything. We're also told that rapid testing is the route out. Sheffield City Council yesterday basically said to the care homes, homes in their area don't use these lateral flow tests because they're not safe enough. They miss up to 50% of cases. We've got a vaccine that we don't have approved yet. Goodness knows when it's going to be rolled out. We've got tests that are unreliable, either PCR tests, which give far too many false positives, and or rapid flow tests, which give far too many false negatives. We don't have a route out of this medically right now, other than the political decision to end all these crazy restrictions and trust the British people to do sensible things. Yeah, OK, ban massive big crowds and wild parties and the like, but to trust the British people that they will take measures to keep themselves, their families, their loved ones, their colleagues, their neighbours, other people in society safe. Why do you think the government doesn't trust the British people?
Well, I've said all the way through from the very beginning of the pandemic that the government, I don't want the government, and the government can't legislate for how people should behave in every circumstance throughout the pandemic. People have got complex lives with complex relationships, and people have got to use their common sense to have how to react and keep themselves safe and prevent the transmission of the virus. All these guidelines are not here to make people's lives a misery. They're supposedly to stop the transmission of the virus. People have got to use their common sense to protect themselves and protect the family around them and their community. And that's what's got to happen.
Across the UK, online, on DAB and on your smart speaker, Talk Radio.
Let's talk about some of the scientific advice which the government should be listening to. I have a funny feeling if they've been listening to people like my next guest, we might be in a different position today. Professor Tim Spector is a lead scientist on the Zoe COVID symptom study app. It's been one of the most accurate apps in terms of a million people telling them their symptoms every day and really tracking just how this virus is spreading. He's also a professor of genetic epidemiology at King's College London and joins us now. Good morning to you, Tim.
Good morning.
Julia. Now, I know you don't get involved in the politics of all of this, and quite rightly, as a scientist. However, you have been producing evidence throughout this pandemic showing the likely prevalence of infections and looking at the data on hospitalizations and, of course, deaths, which follow on with a really pretty regular time lag between all those things. The evidence that we were given for going into a lockdown was pretty clearly debunked within hours by people like Professor Carl Hennigan of Oxford University about this 4,000 a day thing. But we've been told the lockdown did work and that tiers work and that tiers, we need to go back to more tier restrictions. Does the evidence that you're seeing as a genuine expert in this field, does that suggest that these restrictions are needed?
I think it's complicated and everything is all about timing. Because everything the government has said might have been true at a different time point. And it's just the problem is that by the time they get information, they have a decision, and then they have this long process of discussion and then all the politics that follows, the decisions they made often several weeks ago are no longer applicable in this very fast-moving area. So that seems to be the major problem here is that they're not able to use the latest data to inform the latest sort of major countrywide and political decisions.
So even with the tier restrictions, a lot of the decision was made last week, but it was using data that was already a week out of date, we understand.
Exactly. So they're not using the most up-to-date data. They're using older data and older models in their projections that are in a rather narrow range of these estimates. So they're not taking all the estimates from different groups that, you know, have a very focused idea. And by the time they get to apply these models, the situation has moved on. And then what they're now doing is, in a way, retrospectively justifying their decisions with some other statistics. So, you know, I think most people are in general agreement that the tier system was working and that they didn't hold their nerve enough and weren't using the latest data, which had always showed that before we went into lockdown, a lot of these measures had started to bite in the north and Liverpool and places like this, where the curve had already turned and was on the way down. And this was, you know, they'd reached the peak and were going down. And so the extra measures, you know, didn't really, haven't been proven to have made a bigger difference than, say, those tier three ones in those badly affected areas. Because what we're seeing is there's a two-week lag roughly from when we see new cases starting to fall and when admissions fall, and that's been proven to be true. So we're now, we saw over a month ago in the north, where everything happened in Scotland, the north, things started changing, and then that trend has moved south. 2 weeks later, we see admissions around the country falling, and that's what we're seeing pretty much everywhere now. And so the idea that the NHS is currently overrun really isn't borne out by the current data. If you look at the very latest data, we're seeing 80 to 85% capacity across most trusts, with an exception of a handful. And I do accept there are areas where, you know, the NHS is under strain, as it is in most years, and we do need to take that into consideration.
A lot of this, isn't it? It's about a proportionate response, something I've been arguing for some months, but also it's about seeing things in context. So people are saying, well, we've got these excess deaths. There are people dying. This isn't a hoax. This is a real virus. It kills people, and we don't want anybody to die of this virus who can be saved. But in order to save people from dying of this virus, some of the measures that are required may end up, as we know, costing more lives, costing more livelihoods, the economic costs, et cetera, et cetera. So it's about a proportionate response. But we also had a situation where we do have some excess deaths this year, right now. However, these are not unusual excess deaths. When we do a comparison, say, with a five-year average, we have an older population now. We know the baby boomers coming to the age where, sadly, they will be reaching the end of their lives. We're likely to see an increase in death rates anyway because of that large, big population bulk. But we saw it in the year 2000. Was it 48,000 excess deaths from flu? The year 2018, we had excess deaths. We have years where we have more people who die of various viruses every year. Are the deaths that you're seeing right now, are they out of the ordinary?
Well, it depends how you describe ordinary. They're certainly bigger than average, and there's no doubt there are excess deaths. Current estimates put it, there are different estimates, but it looks like at the moment it's around, at this time of year, around 10% above the five-year average. But of course it would have been more if we'd done as in a normal year and done nothing. So I think the measures we've brought in have reduced that. So it's always trying to work out what the natural one is and where we are at the moment. Because most of the models assume we're going to just do nothing and be like lemmings and jump off the cliff.
Which is stupid, because we wouldn't do that. Even with just voluntary measures, we wouldn't do that.
Correct. When we start seeing neighbours and friends, you know, ill and going to hospital, then people change naturally their behaviour. And this is why these voluntary restrictions, these sort of tier ones and tier twos, do actually work pretty effectively. And it's sort of unclear whether some of these more extreme ones have a greater effect if rates are going up anyway, because people do naturally behave well when they see that they are really in a crisis situation. And I think that's perhaps where I would like to see more trust given to people to behave that way. And to do that, we need to give people more information. At the moment, you know, we're not seeing local hospitals overrun in the vast majority of areas, despite what some politicians have said, where, you know, claiming the whole country was about to break down. We didn't recognise that in the data, and we still don't. Positions is slowly getting better every day, which is great, and that does mean people to behave responsibly. But I think what people need is local information that will allow them to themselves see which tier they should be going into. So I've got no problem with the tier system itself. I just think we need to change the criteria for going in and out of them.
Online, on DAB, and on the Talk Radio app. Talk Radio.
Thanks for listening to the Julia Hartley Brewer Daily. If you liked what you heard, please subscribe and give me a good review. And don't forget to catch me on the Talk Radio Breakfast Show every weekday from 6:30 until 10.
This is the summer to expand your horizons. It's time to explore. But before you set foot out the door, set foot in the ultimate travel shoes from Allbirds. Like the breathable, silky smooth tree dasher, the responsive foam and extra grip of the tree runner, or the classic low-top look of the tree piper. Allbirds has a lightweight, ultra-packable shoe ready for whatever adventures you have planned. Boarding pass? Check. Passport? Check. The perfect travel shoe? Check. Find your perfect pair at Allbirds.com. That's Allbirds.com.